Thank you, Cass.
Thanks, James.
That was so nice, so moving. Some might say shrill voice, but I hope it's a voice for progressive movement ahead. I'd like to thank Cass for bringing me up here before ALA, and the Engine, the UW Information School, Elise, University of Washington Libraries. I mean, that's a pretty prestigious number of groups that had me come here. So it's really nice to have me to talk with you today. And I hope that it'll be worth your while. First thing I want to do. I didn't think I was going to do
that's
that.
Okay.
I want to dedicate this to.
Sorry.
Wow. Yeah,
James, it's okay. Take a few minutes, and I can read too
so
if you
funny.
Need me to.
You know, I practiced this about 100 times and never once sort of choked up. I want to dedicate this to Aaron Schwartz, who died a couple weeks ago. And I want to donate this to the public domain. And as Aaron said, Aaron, he was an amazing person. And he wrote these licensing haikus. And one of the haikus that he wrote was for the public domain. Do what you feel like, since the work is abandoned, the law doesn't care. Mm-hmm. So, I promise I won't choke up at all the rest of the time. Wow, that's interesting. And I'm not even a crier, except for during It's a Wonderful Life. If anybody else knows that movie. So we're at the very beginning of the digital era, where tools and policies and best practices are all in flux. In many ways, we're at the age of new metaphors needed to describe what it is that we do as librarians on a daily basis. So today I'd like to talk about some of the historical ideals of the FDLP and discuss how those ideals have been under fire from both within the library community as well as without the library community, and sort of argue that those ideals applied to today's new information metaphors give us the best chance at access to and long-term preservation and assurance of government information. Then I'll talk about some of the collection strategies that I use that I've found to be successful, and then conclude with a bit about collaboration and some to-dos for all of us. Hopefully you'll follow me along. So just as a reminder, librarians basically explore, collect, describe, share, and preserve the world of information. In my humble estimation, format doesn't change what it is that we do as librarians. Today I aim to show that the shift to digital does not preclude us from exploring, collecting, describing, sharing, and preserving government information, and all information, I might add. Right up front, thank you, Cass, for that really nice introduction. I'm a librarian and a collaborator for LOX US Docs, and so I've been in academia and education my whole life as a student, a teacher, a librarian, a technologist. And I've worked in libraries, as Cass said, since I was in high school. My first library job, I was an actual librarian, but I didn't have a degree, so everybody gets mad at me when I say that. But I worked as a co-librarian at a one-person library, and so that was a really cool experience for me. And I've been a government information librarian since 2002.
2002. 10 years.
And so that's my mindset, my perspective, my bias is from one who assists in the scholarly communication process, one who believes that libraries have a place in the digital information landscape, and one who believes strongly in the idea that public access to government information is a fundamental right. In the print era, which is not over by any stretch of the imagination, we had rules and processes in place to do the things that we do as librarians. In the digital realm, which is just beginning, and in my estimation will continue to overlap with the paper, with the print era for a long time to come, we're just beginning to figure out those rules and those processes. But the concepts, I feel, remain the same. Government documents are really the DNA of the democratic process. Carl Malamud would call it the source code of the democratic process. And so we really have to find ways to continue to give access and preserve that content for the long term. A little bit about, a little background. The FDLP has been around since 1813 in some form or another. I'm glad you're taking notes, that's awesome. That means I'm saying something. The basis underlying the need for the FDLP is to give the public free access to government information. Depository libraries have long safeguarded the public's right to know by cooperating with and receiving publications published by the GPO, the Government Printing Office. If I throw out any acronyms and you don't know what they are, just raise your hand and I'll. Government Printing Office.
FDLP.
Federal Depository Library Program. I thought everybody knew that. I even hassle my parents and their friends. I'm like, go into the library. FDLP. So the libraries, FDLP libraries, have worked with the GPO to organize, maintain, and preserve those publications, assisting users in accessing that information in a geographically dispersed system. And most importantly, to my mind, assuring that government information is freely available and tamper-proof. Taken together, the collections of the 1,250 or so, I think it's 1,250, might be a little less now, the 1,250 libraries, depository libraries, make up the historic corpus of public government information available for free to every citizen. Jesmyn West of Librarian.net, who's also a UW iSchool graduate, she once called the FDLP the longest running open source project in support of democratic ideals. I hope I don't choke up every time I name somebody. Jesmyn's a good friend of mine as well. And if you haven't seen Librarian.net, you should go to her site, because she tracks on lots of library technology issues for public libraries. She works in Vermont, she's great. So over the last 20 or 30 years, developments in publishing and the internet technologies have affected the way that government information is produced, disseminated, controlled, and preserved. These changes have affected the policies and procedures of the GPO, and in turn have affected the Depository Library Program. Despite the often heard promises that web technologies will bring more information to more people more quickly and easily, the actual effects have been decidedly mixed. The highly visible short-term successes of the large number, the short-term successes of rapid dissemination of single titles directly to citizens, for example, the large number of downloads of the 9/11 report, which I think got several million downloads in the first day, masks the loss of a secure infrastructure for long-term preservation of and access to government publications as more and more agencies publish their content on their own websites and rather than using the GPO conduit, which we in the government information world call fugitive documents. You'll hear a lot more about fugitive documents. And very few agencies actually publish to any standards or have policies in place to deal with archiving and preservation. As Chuck Humphrey, a data librarian friend of mine, once said, there seems to be an inverse relationship between convenience of dissemination and preservation standards. Ha, I didn't choke up for Chuck.
You got a question.
Got a question, yes.
Agencies, you mean the government agencies?
Yes. Government agencies, Department of State, Department of Justice, those kinds of things. So in addition to this lack of a secure infrastructure, the growing din of the call for digitization of historic government publications, I refuse to use the term legacy. From some of the large library associations like the ARL, ACERL, the Association of Southeast Research Libraries, the CIC, the Big Ten Libraries, who are doing a big Google project now, while no doubt this will be a boon for access today, and if anyone's used HathiTrust before, you know that there's a lot of really great content in HathiTrust. But the digitization of government publications has their own unique issues in terms of metadata, provenance, findability, and usability, etc.
And this is somewhat of a red herring, I think, that that makes library administrators, not librarians themselves, but the administrators believe that they'll soon be able to dispose of their physical collections, not to mention their documents staffs, and use that space for this week or next week's buzzword, in learning commons, whatever you want to call it. This call for digitization may instead have the deleterious effect of damaging the long-term preservation of government publications. Lastly, the growing trend toward privatization of government information has actually caused a decrease in public access despite its digital nature. This is not a new trend, of course. Herb Schiller noted in his 1986 book, Information and the Crisis Economy, a really great book if you get a chance to read it. Speaking of machine-readable formats, he wrote, I'll read it here, he wrote that, quote, library information capability is greatly enhanced, yet this benefit is accompanied by the abandonment of libraries' historic free access policy, user charges are introduced, the public character of the library is weakening as its commercial connection deepens. No less important, the composition and character of its holdings change as the clientele shifts from general public to the ability to pay user. This is 1986. We've seen over the last several years a disturbing rise in federal agencies entering into contracts with private companies, whereby public domain government documents are digitized and then taken out of the commons via licensing agreement. See, for example, this is the GAO, the Government Accountability Office, ironically, Government Accountability. In 2009, I think, or maybe 8, made a deal with Thomson West, whereby Thomson West digitized somewhere over 20,000 legislative histories from the GAO from 1915 to 1995, and in return received exclusive license to sell that content. And GAO received nothing in return but a login to the Thomson service, and the public received nothing at all. Last year, you may have heard, NARA entered into a contract with Ancestry.com to serve out the 1940 census schedules, pardon me, aka the enumerator's notebooks. These are the census, the actual handwritten names of the censuses. It's a boon to genealogists. These are released after 72 years. And Ancestry agreed to be NARA's digital infrastructure, offering free access for a year until April of this year. And then afterwards, anyone who wanted to access that would need an Ancestry subscription in order to access the schedules. And don't get me started about IBM and Census's Fact Finder website. Rapid technological change and the misplaced assumption that it's all in Google have caused some in the FDLP community to question the need for the FDLP, and some others to drop out of the program altogether. It was one of the reasons why I was like, oh, it's 1250, 1230, the numbers are going down. I believe that the inherent nature of digital information actually increases the need for a distributed network of dedicated legislatively authorized libraries and librarians. And I think that's key, the legislatively authorized. It would be prudent to draw upon the existing infrastructure of FDLP libraries and the 200 plus years of experience of these institutions in assuring preservation of and access to government information. We must reinforce the FDLP's traditional mission of selection, collection, free access, and preservation in the digital era in order to assure free access to this information into the foreseeable future. I'm sorry this turned out to be kind of small-ish. I don't know if you can see that. It's sort of a sideways bow tie with federal agencies on the top and a content inflow to FedSys, the GPO's federal digital system. It used to be called the future digital system, right, when it was in beta. And then through flow and a fail-safe to FDL's Federal Depository Libraries. And then the public is that big yellow globe. So nobody knows for sure how to preserve digital content for the long term. This means to me that a loosely coupled, independently administered, distributed ecosystem is the best way to assure long-term preservation. many organizations with many funding models and distributed technical infrastructures have a far better shot at preservation than one or two organizations, especially if one of those is a government agency with a tenuous budget, or is a private corporation, for example. Dave Weinberger described the web in this way in his book Small Pieces Loosely Joined. I don't know if anyone's read that. It's a really good read if you get a chance. And I think that metaphor holds true for libraries as well. This is sort of a back of the napkin kind of sketch that I did a few years back on how to imagine what the FDLP community or the FDLP ecosystem would look like. So I imagined information flowing from agencies into FedSys, which would have content management, catalog, Perl server, API, distribution of digital files, and metadata. And all of that content would be at FedSys, but it would also flow out to depository libraries, where depository libraries could continue to build digital collections and have redundant infrastructure, local collections and services, distributed digital storage, and all of that. And the public would see seamless access. They wouldn't know, or wouldn't need to know any of that stuff on the left-hand side. They would get their content through FedSys, through search engines, through OPACs, through institutional repositories, through mashups where people are pulling data from FedSys API and building new services out of that. They wouldn't need to see any of the sausage makings, so to speak, but they would get seamless access. So how would each of these scenarios deal with or react to a different stress situations or threat models, the scenarios being one or two or a whole ecosystem? Threat models such as reduced budgets, increased demand for privatization, increased demand for censorship or control or removal of information, media, hardware, software, network failure, natural disaster, organizational failure, all of these threat models. It's easy, at least in my mind, to see that the highly replicated, distributed model of preservation based on common open digital standards and things like OAIS, the Open Archives Information System, that's for you, the acronym, would deal with these situations much better than a centralized model. A web, of course, is much stronger than a silo. And this holds true for all information, in my humble opinion, not just government information. So now I'll sort of step off my soapbox for a bit, and I'm sure to get back on it later, but for now I'll shift gears and talk a little bit about practical matters and about my strategy for collection development and long-term preservation in the FDLP ecosystem. So I'll run through a few examples for you on how to conceptualize and actually do digital collection development. I like to use a water metaphor to describe my processes. I think it makes my mind think better. So in the digital realm, I think we have to collect water, whether it's drops of water or waterfalls or the wide ocean. So first I'll talk about the droplets of water. EAMS. EAMS are everyday electronic materials. Thank you. EAMS was a Mellon Foundation grant at Stanford to build digital infrastructure and workflow and policies to support the collection, description, preservation, and public access of digital objects by bibliographers and subject specialists. EAMS are those digital materials that are serendipitously referenced in news reports or distributed by postings on websites or through email notification to scholars and bibliographers. Those items that selectors come across in the course of doing their everyday work. In the past, librarians may have downloaded documents to their desktops and perhaps printed them out and had them bound if their administrations were amenable. I don't know if UW is amenable to that, but some were for a little while anyway. Now we've got a digital stacks. With EAMS, we've got a digital stacks in order to collect, preserve, and give access to that information. For those interested in more in-depth about EAMS, there's a citation at the last slide to my colleague Catherine Cott's report for CNI, Center for Networked Information, two summers ago, I think. There's a link there. And if anybody wants to Google it now, you can Google Cott, Eames, CNI, and you'll find the report. So with Eames, and I could show you on my computer, but I couldn't get it connected to the projector. The subject specialist workflow is pretty simple. You identify a document. Right now we're only doing PDFs and we're only doing monographs. We're working on a way to do serials, but it's a little trickier for serials. You drag the URL of the document, the PDF that you found, to the Eames browser widget. There's a little widget that you install on your browser. You determine the copyright status, which I don't normally have to do because government information is in the public domain. But if material is copyrighted, we're required by our university council to actually contact the copyright owner and ask them for permission. I've done that to, I think, 3 or 4 different organizations, and so far everybody said, sure, no problem. So so once you have the document and you stick it into the widget, a little box comes up and you fill in author, title, notes, copyright status. You submit it to the acquisitions and cataloging folks, and then they take it, they catalog it, they stick it in our digital repository, and they make it accessible through our catalog. My Eames workflow also includes fugitive documents, reporting fugitive documents to the GPO, and I'll describe that in a second.
Real quick, James?
Yeah.
After you check the copyright status and you send it to cataloging,
yeah,
they do original cataloging for the...
They'll look for copy, but if there's no copy, then they'll do original cataloging. Sometimes,
is there a classification that they do along with it?
A classification like LCSH,
number.
A call
yeah.
number? There's not a call number,
right,
per se, because it's not on a shelf. That's a good question. I think if they find, like if I send them a government document, for example, from the Department of Justice, they'll look and see if there's a SUDOC classification for that. And I think they do add that to the note. So that if somebody actually wants to search in our catalog by Department of Justice, SUDOC classification. Not that many people know the SUDOC for Department of Justice, so.
Jay.
Yeah,
but
except you guys.
Speaking of,
yes.
If you found a DOJ
uh-huh.
document
yeah.
and you sent it to Eames and it wasn't in, if GPO hadn't captured it, would you also report it? Is
yeah.
that what that
Yep, was? That's what I'm getting to now.
Okay.
So my work with Eames grew out of two other projects. Focusing on fugitive government information, and as you can probably tell, fugitive documents are a passion of mine. I'm a fugitive documents hunter. But particularly through the work of the Lost Docs blog, this is lostdocs.freegovinfo.info. Daniel Cornwall and John Waters, I think his name. They're the two that mostly run the Lost Docs blog. But the Lost Docs blog tracks fugitive government, fugitive document submissions to the GPO in order to provide a public listing of fugitive documents. So when folks in the documents community report something to GPO, GPO sends back an email saying, yes, we've received this. And Lost Docs just asks people to forward that receipt, and then we post it online. And we track how long it takes for the GPO to actually catalog stuff and things like that. For some reason, they never wanted this to be a project that the GPO worked on officially. But that's aside. So through the Lost Docs blog, I was able to target several different agencies that generally are the worst offenders of fugitive documents. Here's some of them, the Bureau of Land Management, especially the field offices for the Bureau of Land Management. And in general, the local and regional offices of lots of federal agencies tend to be really, really bad at distributing their documents. So we also found that there were three other agencies, the EPA, the GAO, and Census Current Industrial Reports, that just published too many documents. And so I'm collecting those, I'm harvesting those through another project, and I'll describe that project next. I do have an acquisition staff person who works about 3 hours a month or so, and she goes in and she checks the agency publications pages for new publications. She checks the CGP, the Catalog of Government Publications, GPO's catalog, to see if the document has made it into the CGP, and then she submits the fugitive report to the GPO, and she uploads the PDFs to the EAMS tool. Besides these federal agencies here, I also scour the news. I'm a news junkie as well, and I have a Google alert set for leaked and newsworthy government documents. So for example, I just yesterday sent in an EAM for a debunked Library of Congress report on Iranian intelligence. Folks may have heard about that. It was written about on ProPublica, where the Library of Congress wrote this report, and it turns out that the report didn't have any basis in reality. in my mind, it's sort of like reverse engineering of the collection development process.
Can you all see that?
Sorry. So through the EAMS workflow to date, we've been able to collect over 400 documents, like this one here, the National Space Policy of the United States of America. Notice the Perl there. Perl is a permanent URL for docs librarians. We know that GPO does Perls for their documents. We have a Perl server working at Stanford as well. So we preserve them locally in the Stanford Digital Repository, and we give access to them through the catalog here. But think about what we could do if 100 libraries or 1,000 libraries did this. Collectively, I think we could cover all federal agencies and assure that no born digital document within scope of the FDLP, or even without scope of the FDLP, falls through the cracks and becomes fugitive. Next, I'll talk about, is there any questions so far?
Good. Are these documents cataloged in WorldCat? So
yes.
We'll find a link through WorldCat?
Yep, they do get into WorldCat. And eventually they do get into the CGP, and so if you have documents without shelves, if you have an archive service, you will get the bib records in your downloads eventually. And I assume when GPO gets a fugitive, they store it on their own server. They're not pointing to our server. It would be nice if they did, but.
James, one more.
Yeah.
So you're doing this at Stanford. Do you mm-hmm. have any other partners who you know of are doing this kind of things?
No, you want to help?
That's why I'd love to. You want to give me some money?
We'll talk afterward. let's see. So next, I want to talk about Archive-It. Are there any Archive-It partners here? Is UW doing Archive-It? No? All right. Talk to me later. Archive-It is a subscription service from the Internet Archive, which, by the way, has tons of digital copies of historic government publications, as well as digitized microfilm, which is really cool if you're hot for enumeration district maps and things like that. I don't know, for some reason I've gotten lots of census questions in the last couple of weeks, so I'm really good with enumeration districts. Archive-It is an easy subscription building, collection building tool, whereby you give the software a list of URLs, which Archive-It calls seeds. You schedule the crawler to harvest those seeds, and then you give public access to the content collected. It's a good way to contextualize or make sense of the ocean of information on the open web. Since 2007, I've been using the service since 2007, I've crawled, I just checked this yesterday, 58,590,127 documents, which is a little misleading because a document in Archive-It parlance can be anything from a spacer GIF to an MP4 file to a PDF. It's anything that it finds on the website. But the data that I've archived to date is 4.6 terabytes of data. What I'm collecting, this is the link to our homepage, archiveit.org/home/SSRG. SSRG is an acronym standing for Social Science Resource Group, which is the group within the libraries that I work at. originally the archived subscription was going to be the whole social science resource group, but I was the only one that continued to use it. So, but we're collecting things like CRS reports from lots of different websites, both government and non-government websites that post CRS reports. CRS is the Congressional Research Service. If any of you don't know it, CRS reports are way cool because they do original research for congressional members, and those reports have, especially the footnotes and things like that. If you're ever on the reference desk and you need, an undergrad comes in on any topic, go to CRS reports and you'll find really great information about it. Yeah?
Was the Iranian report a CRS report?
It was not a CRS report. It was a report that Library of Congress got contracted to do from, my browser
okay.
closed down, but yeah, it wasn't through CRS. It was, they got contracted through another office. I'm also collecting websites for FOIA documents and agency FOIA reading rooms. FOIA is the Freedom of Information Act. When someone requests internal documents from any government agency, if they get requested enough, the agency will eventually put those documents into their FOIA reading rooms. So every agency, Department of Justice, Department of State, et cetera, Department of Interior, they all have these FOIA reading rooms on their websites, and I'm collecting those. But I'm also collecting the FOIA documents that Stephen Aftergood gets, and the National Security Archive, and lots of other places. Yeah.
When you say you're collecting these stuff, does that mean you're like getting the PDFs and like adding them to your catalog, or how are they being collected?
Yeah, I'm not cataloging those individually because those are 4.6 terabytes worth of data. So I'll show you in a second how we're giving access to them. We are giving public access, but not through the catalog. And unfortunately, I think my catalogers would kill me if I, if I sent 4.6 million documents through the EAMS tool. They would just say no. So I'm collecting fugitive US agencies like the EPA and the GAO. I'm also collecting local stuff. So I've got a collection on Bay Area governments. This is local, regional, and state agency offices in the Bay Area. So I'm trying to collect those because if you think federal content is hard to find and hard to track and hard to preserve, state and local stuff, nobody's even thinking of state and local stuff, so let alone the state and local agencies themselves. But that's for another talk. Let's see, so this is, I don't know if you can see this, this is some of the seeds from the CRS report collection. So you can see I'm collecting opencrs.com. The University of Maryland has a CRS report site. University of North Texas has a great CRS collection. And also things like state.gov. Some of the foreign service sites actually post CRS reports for some weird reason, like the Italian consulate. I have no idea why, but somebody at the Italian consulate posts CRS reports. So this is just a snapshot of some of the seeds. We do have I have a cataloger who likes to do Dublin Core, luckily, and so he does Dublin Core metadata at the collection level and at the seed level, but not at the document level. Archive, it does allow to do metadata at the document level, but obviously it's just too many documents, so we haven't done that yet. We're in the planning stages, though, to index the metadata that's created in Archive it for our catalog. Our catalog is searchworks.stanford.edu, and SearchWorks runs on a piece of open source software called Blacklight. And Blacklight indexes, it's a solar index, so it indexes both MARC and non-MARC metadata, which is really cool. And so we're able to throw whatever metadata we have, we can throw at it. And they just haven't gotten a chance to do that yet. We're also planning to feed archived collections into our locks boxes for long-term for redistribution and long-term preservation. This is what the search looks like on archived. We give access to the collections via full-text search. Archive it does full-text search, full-text indexing. And we also have cataloged each of the collections for our databases page. So any student goes to databases.stanford.edu, they can see those collections there. And our crawled seeds are also brought into the Wayback Machine for public access. Anybody know about the Wayback Machine? Yeah, good. For you code geeks, search can also be embedded in other HTML pages. So if you want afterwards, I'm going to give these slides to Cass. Feel free to copy the JavaScript there if you want, or just write it down. It's a strange joke at tech conferences. Everybody has to have a slide with gratuitous code in it. It can be XML, it can be JavaScript, it can be whatever, but you have to. Yeah, it's like having a cat slide, which I should have put in here, but I didn't.
Yes.
Don't worry, it's coming. So lastly, I'd like to mention the waterfalls that are Locks US Docs. Locks combines the best of targeted web harvesting with collaboration and distributed preservation. Locks stands for Lots of Copies Keep Stuff Safe, and it was built at Stanford in 1999. The Locks software was built to solve the problem of long-term preservation of digital content. It's an open source distributed digital preservation system based on open standards like OAIS, OpenURL, HTTP, and WARC, which is the web archiving format. Originally, Locks was focused on journal literature only, but in the last 10 years, there's lots of other projects that have used Locks, like government information, theses and dissertations, numeric data. Anybody heard of the Dataverse? No, there's no data librarians. Can I get a data librarian? The Dataverse is really cool, it's out of Harvard. The goals of Locks are to spread out the economic cost of and responsibility of digital preservation and use off-the-shelf hardware and open source software so that libraries and content publishers can easily and affordably create, preserve, and archive local, that's the key, electronic collections, and readers can access those archived content transparently through the original URLs, as well as through links resolvers like SFX, which I talked to before. So think of a Locks box as a digitally distributed depository library. There's two pieces to the Locks software. This is one piece. The first piece is that any site that gives Locks, that puts up a Locks permission statement, for example, fedsys.gov, has put up a permission statement for all of their 44 collections. Any site that has a permission statement listed, Locks can go and harvest that content. It's sort of the Locks software looks for that permission statement in order to do what it does. And the cool part, this is the cool part, although it doesn't really look all that cool in there. But Locks goes through a process of checking and polling all digital content in all of the Locks boxes on a network. And if one box has content that's different from all the other boxes, the Locks software will fix the content so that all of the boxes are the same. It's sort of like injecting stem cells into the network and replicating and fixing content that becomes corrupted over time. So Locks is really, really simple in its elegance, I think, and it's proven very effective in keeping local digital content safely preserved over time. So given that description, I guess you can see why some in the documents community have been excited about Locks and why we decided to implement Locks US Docs. Portland State and Simon Fraser Universities are the closest partners to UW, but I'm always looking for more partners. But using the Locks software, we're re-implementing the tamper-evident distributed preservation system for digital documents. So rather than a central silo on a .gov server somewhere, the digital documents reside currently in 36 servers at 36 different libraries. We're collecting all of the 44 collections that are currently on FedSys. That includes things like the Federal Register, public papers of the president, the GAO reports, U.S. statutes at large. There's a bunch more on there, and GPO is just started working with the Department of the Treasury, I think, wasn't it, to put some of their historic documents. So FedSys has a lot of coverage from many of the documents from the early 90s to the present, some historic going back as far as the 1950s in digital format. Let's see. So in, save that for a minute. In the 2008 Blue Ribbon Task Force on Sustainable Digital Preservation and Access, Abby Smith Rumsey wrote, "Access to valuable digital materials tomorrow depends upon preservation actions taken today. And over time, access depends on ongoing and efficient allocation of resources for preservation." So LOX US Docs, we're taking the collective responsibility today for long-term preservation of digital depository materials. Now I'm going to get back on my soapbox for a minute. I'm almost done though. Don't worry. So as you can see, the technological tools are there, at least some of the tools are there already. But I think there's a need for a Farmington Plan Redux. For those of you who aren't library historians, the Farmington Plan was an ARL program from 1948 to 1972, in which they did collaborative collection development, where subscribing libraries would be in charge, they would be responsible for collecting and cataloging research materials in certain subject areas and linguistic areas, you know, South Africa or wherever. And then they would distribute records to those materials in the form of cards, in the form of 3x5 cards, to the National Union Catalog. I think this was a pretty brilliant idea to do collaborative collection development. So moving forward, I think we need to do a Farmington Plan Redux and build a digital FDLP reservoir. This is the Hetch Hetchy Reservoir in California. That's the water I drink at home, so it's really nice. So first and foremost, I think, and Cass and I have talked a bit about this before, but I think we need to set up a summer digital FDLP institute modeled on the ICPSR Data Library Workshop. That Data Library Workshop has trained a generation of data librarians. It's really amazing. It's done by a couple of old-time data librarians. The institute, I sort of imagine, would train GovDocs librarians and others interested in government information on the ins and outs of the Open Archival Information System, OAIS, open digital library tools and standards. And my friend and FGI co-conspirator Jim Jacobs and I just wrote a soon-to-be-published article in DLib about a standard that we're suggesting be implemented called the Digital Surrogate Seal of Approval, or DSSOA. Another acronym. That'll just roll off your tongue. But the Digital Surrogate Seal of Approval is sort of like Bobby. Do people remember Bobby?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
For HTML pages. So, you know, it proved that your site was accessible and had a little cute icon on it. The DSSOA is the same thing. You would put it on digital collections, and you would would show the quality and the accuracy of existing surrogates, digital surrogates, you know, content that was digitized from printed books and other materials. But that's just an aside. The Institute would teach techniques for expanding access to both digital and paper collections. It would give librarians a framework for updating their understanding and have increased awareness for digital archival concepts, and build and expand their digital toolboxes to include web harvesting, digital information collection and organization, building and utilizing web tools and the semantic web. That's sort of the big plan, and I'm hoping Cass and I can talk about that more while I'm here. But I also feel like part of the Farmington Plan Redux is that every documents library or librarian should adopt a federal agency, or like I mentioned earlier, a local or a regional office of a federal agency. submit fugitive documents to the GPO for inclusion into the CGP and distribution out to other depositories. That would go a long way towards digital collection development. I hope folks will join LOCKS and TRAIL, the Technical Reports Archive and Information Library. I'm sorry Mel Desart isn't here today, but Mel's been instrumental in building up TRAIL. And Stanford became a TRAIL member a year and a half ago or something. And any other digitization or digital preservation projects. And another thing that is a key piece of the Farmington Plan Redux is to seed the cloud. And by that I mean start blogging about your questions and answers that you do as part of your work. Start editing Wikipedia articles with library resources. I have to give a shout out to Ann Lally, who I met a little while ago, and Carolyn Dunford for their 2007 DLive article. If you haven't read it, about seeding Wikipedia articles with library resources, it's a really cool. Yeah.
James, you had mentioned to me that one of the things that you learned about from Aaron Schwartz was this issue of, is Wikipedia really controlled by these crazy Wikipedians who don't let anyone add content? Could you speak to that for a minute? Because I know people are interested in that.
Yeah, Aaron did some work on, he actually analyzed all of the edits on Wikipedia and found that Jimbo Wales and the high Wikipedians had always said, oh, it's a small core group of editors who do most of the content creation and editing on Wikipedia. And Aaron analyzed Wikipedia and actually found that that most edits are done by people who log on once or log on twice, make a change, add a link, fix a link, and then go on their way. So he found that actually there were millions of people who were editing Wikipedia. And he did it because he was up for the board of Wikipedia, and so he wanted to analyze, you know, what he was getting into before he got on the board. So he did a really smart article. It's on his website. So the thing about Q&A is, this is sort of an aside, but I'll tell you quickly. In 2007, I think our reference desk, which we call the Information Center, started a blog. And one of the pieces of the blog was a Q&A section. We started writing just the interesting questions and answers that we got over time. And the reference librarians were not all that interested at first, but then I showed them, you're smiling like, oh yeah, I can understand that. Nothing against reference librarians, but I did a Q&A on average tariff levels, which sounds really boring, but I get asked that question a lot as a government documents librarian. And so I wrote a Q&A about it, and then at an info center meeting, I showed them Google search results for average tariff levels. And my Q&A, this link here is to Google search results. That if you search average tariff levels in Google, the first hit is our Q&A. And part of that, part of what I described was our collections, our services, and our resources available to answer that question. And it included free resources, from the World Bank and places like that. But it also included the description of a journal called, the International Customs Journal, which it turns out Stanford's one of the few libraries in North America that has a subscription to this journal. It's done by an IGO in Europe somewhere. And strangely, I was on the reference desk one day, and I got a call from a researcher at Carnegie Mellon, and he was actually looking for that International Customs Journal, and found that through my Q&A, he found that we had a copy of the subscription, and he called the reference desk when I was on the reference desk. Really strange. And we set him up with ILL and sent out all the journals that he wanted to. And it turned out he was working for the IGO that publishes the journal. And so now we're working together to digitize that content. And so it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't taken, I don't know, I probably took 10 minutes or so to write this Q&A. It's not that long, and it just sort of describes some of the resources. But people find stuff. If you seed the cloud, people find your resources, people find library stuff. So I think it's really important to do. And lastly, I think we owe it to ourselves to catalog. I know, you know, my library is the same as lots of libraries that, you know, the 40s through the 80s, they didn't really catalog government documents because they had a government documents librarian and they had the monthly catalog and they had several other bibliographic tools, and it was really expensive and time consuming to catalog government documents. And now we're in a place where, you know, catalogs are online and Google is indexing our catalogs, and documents collections aren't used very much because they're not cataloged and people don't know about them. So if we catalog stuff in our catalogs, if we write Q&As pointing to government documents in our collections, all of these things, I think if we seed the cloud, people will find government documents and start to use them again. And by the way, I started keeping statistics on a reference desk for government documents questions. They hadn't asked that before. It's always, you know, is this a 5-minute directional? Is this more than 5 minutes? Yeah. You know, the standard ARL statistics kind of thing. And I got them to put on the form government documents. And something like 20% of our questions at the reference desk are actually government documents questions. So they're used and they're found, but they're only found and used if we do this kind of stuff. And so I'll just leave you with a little quote from Thomas Jefferson. You know, digital changes a lot of things about information, but it doesn't change the need to collect it, share it, preserve it, and give access to it. As my friend Jim Jacobs says a lot, he says lots of collections keep stuff safe, and I think that's really important. And in other words, documents. It's not a cat, but it's a comic. So. Thanks, everyone. I'll keep up the comic. That's my favorite one. I should have led with that, right? Any questions? Yes.
Tell us more about your institutional repository.
Yeah, so like a lot of libraries, we've been struggling with building our IR for a long time. Since about 2005 or so, we've been promised that we'll have an institutional repository. It's gone through lots of iterations. It's up and running, but right now, other than the EAMS, unless you have big content or special content, the librarians, the line librarians like me, or other, you know, bibliographers, can't actually put content in there. But we do have content from. It's not Art Store. We have a local art archive that we have stored there. We have other kinds of data stored there. We have EAMS stored there. Other kinds of sort of rare special collections we have stored there. Actually, DTTP is stored there.
That's right.
DTTP is Documents to the People. Stanford digitized the historic collections of DTTP from, I don't know, the 70s through, I think, 2000, something like that. So you can get that there. So we do have an IR. It's built off of Fedora. We have lots of people working on it. We have audio collections, a lot of the, we have an archive of recorded sound in the music library that they have some pretty amazing collections that are stored in the SDR, we call it the Stanford Digital Repository.
It sounds like there have to be specialists to get something into it. You know, there are various institutional repositories where they say, oh, you know, you can have different departments put in their stuff.
Yeah.
And it's so easy, anybody can do it.
And we've, I know there's been talk of doing what they're calling self-submission, so that you can put, you know, white papers or preprints of your articles into there, and that's something that they're planning on, but haven't instituted yet. I think they're just trying to figure out the workflows, and they're doing the big collections first, the audio collections, the big data collections. We recently started, our data librarian started a data.stanford.edu, which is a data deposit site for Stanford faculty, and the data sets that faculty submit to data.stanford.edu get put into the institutional repository. So it's sort of like big stuff now, but you know, all of us are chomping at the bit to do the little stuff. Maybe we'll get to do it. When Aaron passed away, there was a tribute to him online, and there's a Twitter hashtag called PDF Tribute, and people were, it was suggested that people should post online copies of their articles, especially JSTOR articles, since Aaron was in trouble for downloading a few JSTOR articles. which he had the right to do, but anyway. So lots of people, I think it's in the thousands now, lots of people have posted their articles to Twitter in that hashtag PDF Tribute. Mm-hmm. And last week I was talking to the head of our digital library systems and services and said, you know, we ought to just harvest that PDF Tribute hashtag, because it has links to all those articles, and then we could have an article depository, and we could index it and get access to it. So he's thinking of ways to that we can do that. Yeah.
Okay. So back to locks and FDSIS.
Uh-huh.
So locks goes to FDSIS and pulls out the stuff.
Yep.
The stuff that's on FDSIS, like the Federal Register,
uh-huh,
is digitally authenticated.
Uh-huh.
Is it then digitally authenticated on locks?
So if you look at a page on the Federal Register or the U.S. budget or one of those other collections that is digitally signed,
yeah,
you know what they call, there's a little eagle on there. You'll still see the eagle if you go into the locks collection and compare them. But on the FedSIS collection, when you click on the eagle, it actually goes to a signature. To a public key kind of thing, PKI. But in the locks cache, it doesn't. So we have the image that it's been digitally signed, but we don't actually have the PKI set up to do the signatures.
So will that be something that you do with the DESSO?
No, the DSSOA. The digital surrogate seal of approval. Yeah,
no.
The digital surrogate seal of approval is more like, you know, if you go to a digital collection, say ProQuest Congressional, just off the top of my head, since I've been fighting with them about some things. ProQuest says, you know, they have everything involved, every document, and every document perfectly scanned, but they've not done this, and very few digital archives have done this. They haven't actually checked every page of every every publication to actually say, yes, we have every page scanned. And I've found times when, you know, somebody comes up and says, I want the congressional record from this day, and it's on this page. And I go to ProQuest, the page isn't there. So, you know, they're human. They miss scan pages and things like that. So that's more what the DSSOA is saying. These digital repositories, you know, Google Books or HathiTrust, or when they say they have 100% of the scans, you know, it tells the public, it's more of a public check to say, here's how we checked to assure that those scans are all there and that all the pages are readable and legible and indexed and don't have, you know, big hands with plastic purple gloves on them. If you've ever seen,
yeah,
there was a blog somebody was doing,
yeah,
that they were collecting
images from Google Books of pages with, you know, hands on them and things.
So how does an entity get that?
They would get that by publicly stating how they checked for assurance that everything is there.
Okay. But there's not a third party that checks on what they checked.
Right.
So they just say it. It can just be in their promotional material.
Yeah. And everybody does that.
Choose to believe it or not.
Yeah. And for the most part, it comes out to be true. But every once in a while, you find a page that's not there. Stanford was one of the original Google libraries, and we to this day get emails from people saying, "Do you have page 124 of this book? It says Stanford on it, but I can't read the page, you know, or the page isn't there, or half the page is there, but half the page is illegible." And we have to send them back to Google. Anyway, thanks for the DSSOA question. Jim will be proud. Yeah.
So I don't understand with FTSIS versus locks, what you're really accomplishing. Are you assuming the GPO is not going to preserve what's in FTSIS? And related to that, you're creating a copy that's not authenticated of a federal document that is authenticated, given in the federal level.
Yeah.
So is that good?
So there's two pieces to that. Let me unwrap that a bit. Not every collection in FedSys has a digital signature to it. It's only the budget, the congressional record, I think. Is there anything else, Peggy,
you remember?
Federal Register.
Bills.
So there's only a couple of collections that actually are signed. But the depository community, GoDaWare, and the FDLP community has been bugging GPO at least since 2002 or 3 to have a mirror of their content, and they've never done it. They have some preservation in their digital repository, but they've never done a mirror. They've never assured the community that, you know, two summers ago the Perl server went down. Do people remember this? The permanent URL server crashed, the GPO Perl server. So, what?
The permanent URL.
Yes, the permanent URL. So, all of these libraries had bib records linking to Perls to the GPO content. And those Perls were broken, right? So, that content disappeared. And the Perl server was down for like 3 weeks. So, that was really bad. In a case like that, if locks, US docs, had been instituted at that time, what would happen is a person would go to that bib record and click on the GPO Perl in the bib record. And if that Perl didn't resolve to the GPO content, it would go to SFX, and SFX would resolve it to the local cache, to the local content in our locks cache.
Oh.
And so that's why I think every library needs to have locks. For U.S. documents, but I know I'm not going to get 1,250 libraries to sign up, but we need more than 36 to do it. And so it's there for assurance. It's there because GPO isn't able to do mirroring in any sort of reasonable way. It's just another digital infrastructure assurance to do it. Just like with the libraries, you know, We had publications that were distributed out to all these libraries. I have a bib record, and somebody goes to my stacks and says, "Oh, this says it's available, and it's not on the stacks, and it's not in microfiche. How can I get it?" Well, I can either do an ILL, look at WorldCat to see what other libraries own that. I can call Cass and ask her to scan something. You know, I can put out a call to gov.gal. And say, "Hey, I need this publication. Can anybody send it to me really quick?" That's the assurance in the paper world that Locks US Docs is doing in the digital world. Yeah.
So, is the Internet Archive still archiving federal government websites?
Yes. So, the Internet Archive is one of the organizations that is doing the end of term crawls.
There's a project with the Library of Congress, Internet Archive, California Digital Library, University of North Texas. There might be one or two others doing it. But they're doing a, they do a major crawl of the .gov domain at the end of a term before, you know, an old president leaves and a new president comes in.
Yeah.
So they're still doing that.
Are their documents accessible through Locks, Docs, US Docs?
No. Currently, right now, Locks US Docs is only the content on FedSys. The Internet Archive there's actually somebody from Locks who's now working for Internet Archive, but they've said that any collections we do with, so for example, Archive It, they would put up a permission statement for my CRS collection if I wanted, and that could be then fed into Locks US Docs. We've started to have discussions in the US Docs group for expanding our collections, but right now the Locks caches are about 1.3 terabytes, and we've asked people to have 3 terabyte hard drives. And so we don't want to just say, oh, and here's another collection, and it's another 2 terabytes of content, and then you're going to have to buy, you know, bigger hard drives and do all that. So we haven't done that yet. And the CRS reports I'm more pleased that Internet Archive has better preservation standards. They have actual mirrors. They have a mirror in Egypt and a mirror in Europe and a mirror somewhere in Northern California, I think. But they have a better preservation model than the GPO does. No offense to the GPO. I love the GPO, but...
It's more like a love-hate thing.
Yeah. It's more like a brother-sister kind of thing,
yeah.
You know?
Let's follow the money for
mm-hmm.
a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Stanford University pays for the server that has your piece of Locks.
Mm-hmm.
Who's paying for the servers that run the Internet Archive?
The Internet Archive is paying for those servers. They Brewster Kahle pays a lot of that out of his own pocket. He was a dot com. He won the .com lottery a couple of times, I'll say. But they run a lot with grants and other sorts of donations. They have a PayPal account and things like that, so people donate money for them to keep their servers up and running.
Also, does an Archive It has a fee associated?
Yes,
yeah.
That's true. And Archive It is not inexpensive. We pay, I think it's $12,000 a year for an Internet Archive subscription. But we, you know, we harvest a lot of content. Yeah, Cass?
Take it in a slightly different direction. When you and I were at the FDLP Depository Library Conference in the fall, and one of the things that GPO was announcing was more work with documents that would look good on mobile devices and other things like that. And they were doing some partnering with different groups around ebooks,
mm-hmm.
and they were naming off all these different collaborators. One of them was Powell's Bookstore, so
uh-huh.
I said, "Yay, Powell's!" And you said, "Boo, ebooks!" You know, you were like,
yeah.
So I thought, can you tell us a little bit more about, you know, what that Boo ebooks was about?
Yeah, the Boo ebooks. And I've asked Mary Alice about this too, and she said, "Don't talk about ebooks."
This is
the
superintendent.
Superintendent.
She's apparently on a first name basis.
Yeah, Mary Alice.
First name
I could call her. So my problem with GPO doing ebooks is that libraries will need to. I don't have a problem with ebooks per se. You know, I have a Kindle reader on my iPhone. I do ebooks once in a while. But the problem is that the same content that GPO is selling through ebooks and requiring libraries to have subscriptions to OverDrive and these kinds of ebook services that are kind of expensive, right? Why should a depository library pay to get an ebook when it's content that should and is, in a lot of times, distributed for free to libraries if they're in the depository program. So my whole problem is that if I'm a depository, I don't want to pay for a book that I get for free as a depository. That's one of the reasons I became a depository, to get that content and to serve it out to my local communities. So I had asked Mary Alice Baish if they would put ebooks on FedSys. And she said, it's not something that they're thinking about right now. They're selling them to Apple, and they're selling them to Overdrive, and these other ebook vendors. So the other problem with ebooks, in my humble estimation, is that a lot of them have DRM to them, digital rights management. And that's a problem, because government information should be free, and you shouldn't have to jump through licensing kinds of hoops in order to read that content. So that was my Ooh, ebooks problem.
Well, technical hoops to
read
ebooks.
Yeah, you know, there's. Yeah, and if somebody gets a depository item through Overdrive, for example, they get it on their Kindle for 2 weeks and then it disappears. But it's public domain content. It shouldn't disappear after 2 weeks.
Where does NTIS fit into any of this?
Oh, NTIS.
You mentioned Trail with the technical reports.
Yeah, I've been trying to talk with NTIS for a while. NTIS is one of these agencies that, like the post office, they're required to be to make money and to hold their own and not have any funding from the U.S. budget, and so. NTIS over the years has sold reports. A lot of those reports are copyrighted as well, because they're done by, not by government agencies, but by contractors.
Right, but they're paid
like
for with government money.
Right. I asked a couple of the people at NTIS, and at every ALA I run into Don Hagen, I think his name is, at NTIS, and I say, can we share metadata? Can we, you know, at least have it so that in Trail, if somebody searches for something, if Trail doesn't have it, we should at least have the metadata that points to NTRL, the National Technical Reports Library, which is NTIS's subscription database. So at least then, if somebody finds it in Trail and they have a subscription to NTRL, they can still get access to it. I think we should be doing a lot more with sharing metadata, at least. If, you know, I'm not supportive of their business model, but I understand their business model. So I would prefer it if they would just serve it out for free.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic but appropriate that they're in the Department of Commerce.
Right.
So
I've also talked to them about giving me copies for Locks, for the Locks US Docs project, so that we could at least preserve that stuff.
Well, I do not want to curtail any kind of conversation that's going on, but there is another group coming in at 3:30, so we have to shuffle on out.
Not to Buffalo, right?
Shuffle off to Buffalo. I want to thank James for coming to ALA a day early and doing this. Just wonderful. We've got coffee, tea, and a whole lot of scones that we'd love to serve you. So come on up to the fifth floor.
All right.
Either way.